Britons are struggling with the issue of faith in the workplace. Two British women, one an airline employee and the other a nurse, were suspended or barred from doing their jobs because they wore crucifixes at work. Now the two are taking their case to the European Court of Human Rights. To find out how this debate is playing out in the UK, we called Lucy Calloway. She's a columnist for the Financial Times, and she joined us from London. Lucy, good to talk to you again.
Hello.
In the U.S., wearing a cross on the end of a chain or a crucifix or any symbol of religious belief is rather common. So what was or what is the logic of the employers, in this case British Airways and the National Health Service, and now the government, which backs them, in deciding that people cannot display a tiny crucifix on a chain at work?
Well, it's against the uniform policy. I mean, the uniform policy in both cases said no visible jewellery, and a crucifix is a piece of visible jewellery, and they were told they couldn't wear it. They both replied that this was a part of their religious faith, and so in preventing them from wearing it, they were being prevented from practising their religion. What then happens is complicated, because the argument is then made quite reasonably that if you're a Christian, you don't have to wear a crucifix. That's a matter of personal choice. It's not as if you're a Muslim, in which case you do need to wear the scarf, or if you're a Sikh, you need to wear the turban. So British Airways argued that it was perfectly voluntary whether or not you wore the cross, but their uniform wasn't voluntary, and if you were a member of staff, you needed to follow it.
But in general, do employees there in the UK not wear crosses or other indications of their faith at work?
I think it's much less common than in the US. And what you also have is lots of people, sort of groovy young teenagers, they might wear sort of aggressive looking crosses without being religious. They just wear it because they think it's funky. So the simple fact that you're wearing a cross doesn't necessarily mean that you're a sincere Christian.
What are average people saying about this?
I mean, I think almost everybody sensible is behind these two women. Who can say that any harm is being done whatsoever by these women? The UK was originally a Christian country. I think people feel that it's quite outrageous as a simple practical matter that they weren't allowed to wear these small, inoffensive crucifixes.
What if British Airways, though, said it's not about her religion, it's still about the jewellery?
Well, I think that's what they were saying, that this contravened their policy and therefore wasn't allowed. But I mean, I think that more sensible companies have rules and then police them intelligently. I think that, you know, it's perfectly plausible that they could turn a blind eye to someone wearing a small cross that's completely inoffensive, and not turn a blind eye if someone comes in with a massive, great bling crucifix that's sort of practically concussing passengers as they hand them their drinks. They could very sensibly say that that was another matter altogether.
What happens now? The two women have gone to the European Court of Human Rights. Is it likely that they'll prevail in that court? And if they were to, what effect might it have on the ruling there in Britain?
Well, I mean, I don't really know, but I think it's not likely that they will win. At any rate, the British government has weighed in against them, pointing out again that the simple fact of being a Christian does not require you to wear the crucifix. So, you know, that's quite a clear sway.
Lucy Calloway is a columnist with the Financial Times, speaking to us from London. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Spool back in time 150 years to the summer of 1862. The Civil War is raging, and President Abraham Lincoln is starting to scribble away at a document, an ultimatum to the rebellious states: return to the Union or your slaves will be freed. Emancipation was a military necessity, the president later confided to his cabinet. Lincoln called it absolutely essential to the preservation of the Union. We must free the slaves, Lincoln said, or be ourselves subdued.
He knew that emancipation would start the tidal wave of freedom and that it was irreversible once it started. But he also knew that more work would be required.
That's Lincoln scholar Harold Holzer, who offers a rethinking of the Emancipation Proclamation in his new book titled Emancipating Lincoln. It's his 42nd book on Lincoln and the Civil War. To those revisionist critics who now say the proclamation was weak, delayed, insufficient, and insincere, Holzer counters, not so. He says Lincoln very carefully calibrated the timing and delivery of this act.
He did things in this run-up that are perplexing, sometimes unattractive, sometimes scary, to prepare the country in his mind for what was going to be a revolutionary moment.
Remember, the country was at war. The stubborn culture of racism made a pro-freedom policy a perilous idea. Lincoln knew it could bring down his administration and the Union. Holzer says Lincoln had to fear a virulent backlash from conservative Northern Democrats opposed to racial equality. And he risked triggering secession from the border states, the slave-owning states that had not joined the Confederacy, Maryland, Delaware, Missouri, and above all, his birth state, the crucially strategic Kentucky.
Lincoln worried that he wanted to have God on his side, but he must have Kentucky.
So it was in that context, in August of 1862, that Lincoln hosted at the White House a deputation of free Negroes, prominent African Americans. His message to them, it was not, you shall be free. No, it was this. It is better for us both to be separated.
And he blames them for the war. Says this, you know, if it wasn't for your presence here, as if it was voluntary in the beginning, this wouldn't be happening. Go where the ban is not upon you, he tells them. Go to the Caribbean, go to Africa. Yeah, they're cruel words, they're harsh words, they're unfriendly.
So how to understand this bitter pill of prejudice, as Holzer calls it? Well, he says it's telling that President Lincoln had summoned newspaper reporters to that meeting.
He wanted this message out. And what's important to keep in mind is that he had written the Emancipation Proclamation. It was languishing in a drawer. It was burning a hole in his pocket. He knew he was going to do this, but he wanted Northern Americans who were dubious about marching toward racial equality to be assured that he was not doing this for the black race. He was doing this for the Union, to reunite the country, to defeat the rebellion, and he had no concern about blacks, their feelings, their residence. He does have his finger in the wind.
Holzer says Lincoln was trying to mold public opinion to make the proclamation palatable, and the president was waiting for the right moment, a Union victory on the battlefield, which finally came at Antietam. Within a week of that victory, Lincoln gave the rebellious states 100 days to obey this ultimatum.
Either return to your legal balance with the Union and this rebellion, or your slaves will be then, henceforward, and forever free.
There was an immediate backlash. Lincoln's Republican Party was punished at the polls in the 1862 elections. Then, on January 1st, 1863, Lincoln was to issue the final decree at the White House.
It was New Year's Day, and by tradition, there was a party. And Lincoln went downstairs early and began receiving guests, and the afternoon comes and goes, and African Americans are gathered in churches. Telegraph operators are already keyed up to bring the glorious news to the church whenever it arrived, and nothing happens.
Why the delay? Well, as Harold Holzer tells it, Lincoln had found a mistake in the handwritten proclamation brought for his signature. The whole thing had to be redone. Back it went to the scribe. It took hours.
And then something fascinating happened. He picked up his pen and put it down. And then he picked it up again and put it down. And people in the room wondered, well, maybe he isn't going to issue it after all. Maybe he just can't bring himself to do it. And then he suddenly began rubbing his fingers with his other hand, rubbing his right hand with his left. And he said, you know, I've been shaking hands for hours, and my hand is almost paralyzed. If I sign the proclamation in a quaking hand, even though my whole heart is in it, people will look at my signature in 100 years and think he hesitated. And he just continued to massage his hand, and then he picked up the pen and signed his full name, which he only did on official documents. And then he looked at the signature, Abraham Lincoln, and said very proudly, there, that will do.
Those words, that will do, just seem like such a paltry way of encapsulating what had just happened.
Well, he had said right before that, if my name ever goes into history, it will be for this act. I think he sensed immediately that he had become one of the immortals.
One misconception about the Emancipation Proclamation would be that once it's signed, boom, slaves are free. Far from that.
Far from that.
Far indeed. Some areas of the South that had already fallen under Union control were not covered by the proclamation. Also exempt were the four border states that owned slaves but had not seceded, so nearly 500,000 people remained enslaved there. And in the Confederate states, freedom came only as the Union soldiers advanced.
Soldiers were armed with these tiny reproductions of the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln had ordered hundreds of thousands of them printed. Suppose an officer gets to a plantation owner that might not understand what he had to sacrifice. Here it is. These guys are free. You got to pay them or let them go, one or the other. And that's how it worked, mile by mile in Southern Territory.
On the cover of Harold Holzer's book is an engraving that shows a scene from April 4th, 1865. It's President Lincoln holding the hand of his young son, Tad, as he enters Richmond, Virginia, just 2 days after Confederate forces had fled their capital. Jubilant African-Americans toss their hats in the air as they greet him.
They rushed over to him and cheered and knelt. And Lincoln famously said, and there were witnesses there, "Please don't kneel to me. You must kneel only to God and thank him for your freedom." This was Lincoln's real emancipation moment. These black workers were actually that moment free under the terms of the proclamation. Here was the Emancipation Proclamation in action. We know also that one particularly wizened old man who was working on the dock was wearing a big straw hat. His reaction to Lincoln when he saw him was to doff this cap in a very grand way and bow to Lincoln. Lincoln took his cap off and tipped his hat to the black man. There were white women, mostly, the men had fled, hiding behind curtains on the second floor of the homes surrounding the shoreline, who were reported to have been looking on with horror at this simple but deeply moving and meaningful gesture. This was Lincoln acknowledging, after all the years of struggle, with the end finally in sight, that this was going to be a different society, a society of mutual respect and not subjugation.
But that moment of quiet triumph was fleeting. Just 10 days later, President Lincoln was assassinated. Harold Holzer's book is Emancipating Lincoln, The Proclamation in Text, Context, and Memory. You can see the engraving from the book jacket and other images inspired by the Emancipation Proclamation at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
On a Wednesday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Here's the good economic news. Employers have been hiring more quickly than the experts predicted.
The bad economic news is that experts still are not sure why employers are hiring so quickly. While the U.S. economy is growing, economists are not sure it is growing quickly enough to justify the many jobs created in recent months.
That concern helps to explain why the Federal Reserve has again said it's going to keep short-term interest rates near zero. NPR's Chris Arnold reports on uncertainty about the economy's future.
Here's the puzzle. If the economy isn't growing that much, then how can the U.S. be gaining so many more jobs?
We have had 5 pretty good months of job growth, certainly the best we've seen since 2007. So that's the good news.
That's Lawrence Katz, a labor economist at Harvard. But he says given the job growth, the economy, our gross domestic product, should be growing faster than it is. GDP usually outpaces job growth in a recovery, but that's not happening. GDP is around 2%, and that's pretty anemic.
So that tells us that something's wrong.
Betsy Stevenson is an economist at Princeton and a former chief economist at the Labor Department. She says you just can't have sustained job gains without stronger overall economic growth. So maybe one thing that's going on, she says, is that the GDP data is just wrong and it'll be revised. On the other hand, if it's not wrong...
Well, certainly, I think there's a lot of speculation going on right now. Are we about to see job growth slow down?
In other words, without the rest of the economy doing better, will the recovery in the jobs market stall out? Lawrence Katz says that idea is troubling because even the job growth that we're seeing right now isn't great, and we need it to get much stronger.
Even if we had a very rapid recovery, we have a huge distance to go still. We are still 10 million jobs behind, so it would take basically 4 years of strong job growth to get back to a normally functioning labor market.
So slower job growth would mean an even longer period of high unemployment and economic hardship for millions of Americans. All these are things that the Federal Reserve lately has been very focused on.
Chairman Bernanke, please begin your testimony.
Thank you.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke recently gave his economic forecast to Congress, and he seemed to be saying, don't get too excited about the unemployment rate, which has fallen sharply in recent months, down to 8.3%.
The decline in the unemployment rate over the past year has been somewhat more rapid than might have been expected, given that the economy appears to have been growing during that time frame at or below its longer-term trend. Continued improvement in the job market is likely to require stronger growth in final demand and production.
In other words, unless economic growth speeds up, the jobs market is still in big trouble.
Notwithstanding the better recent data, the job market remains far from normal.
Some economists see a pretty bleak picture shaping up in all this. Robert Scheimer is a professor at the University of Chicago. He says the unemployment rate is misleading. Yes, it's fallen a lot lately, but he says that's mostly because people are discouraged and dropping out of the labor force. He says if you just look at the percentage of the population that actually has jobs, those numbers don't look so good.
Employment numbers look much more like what's happening in GDP, and those all point to an anemic recovery.
Actually, a really anemic recovery, according to Scheimer.
At the current rates, employment is going to return back to its old trend in something like 8 years, which is a depressingly long period of time.
That sounds pretty dismal, but
there's a little bit too much pessimism.
That's John Sylvia, the chief economist of Wells Fargo. He is more optimistic.
I think 6 to 6.5% unemployment 2 years from now is a reasonable goal. I think a lot of people will be surprised at the strength of the economy in the next 2 or 3 years.
For its part, the Federal Reserve, though, remains cautious, and it stands ready to take more action to boost the economy further if it deems it necessary. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, I'll share my thoughts in my weekly Can I Just Tell You essay. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to the latest in our series for Women's History Month. As women around the world are rethinking and rewriting their own stories, we decided we wanted to dig into some biographies of notable women to see how these stories reflect those changes. So we're hearing about divas of all sorts. Today, we speak about leaders of nations, leaders who were not exactly known as exemplars of sugar and spice and everything nice, women like Cleopatra, who was called Serpent of the Nile, or Mary Tudor, known to history as Bloody Mary, the first queen to rule England. They are featured in a book series aimed at tween girls. It's called The Thinking Girl's Treasury of Dastardly Dames, and the books profile six women who earned both great power and great notoriety, some might say infamy. Here to tell us more is Shirin Yim Bridges. She is the editor and publisher of the series. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I should note that this is actually your second book series aimed at tween girls, although I think others will enjoy them other than tween girls. The first was called The Thinking Girl's Treasury of Real Princesses that was published in 2010. Could you first tell us how you got the idea, and second, tell us how that led to Dastardly Dames?
Well, the idea actually came when I saw my niece, Tegan, who was about 8 years old at the time, getting really fascinated by the Disney princesses. And I have a bit of an issue with some of the messages that those fairy tales tell young girls. It's about being pretty and sitting around waiting for a prince, and then the prince will come and happiness comes after that. So I said to Tegan, did you know that in history, in real life, there have been lots of princesses who did great things, didn't sit around waiting for a prince, but actually went out and changed their own lives and changed history. And she didn't know, so we went looking for these books, and I was very surprised to find that these stories weren't being told to children. So I was already a children's author at that time, and so I decided I would have to write these stories. So that's how the first series came about.
Yeah. So how did that lead to Dastardly Dames? Because when I think about the kind of the biographies that people generally kind of seek out, particularly for younger children, you know, you think heroes and sheroes, the heroic, not too terribly morally complicated is generally the rule, right? And that's not them.
No. The Dastardly Dames also came out of me observing Tegan, because as she got a little older, she was very fascinated by darker, more macabre things. And I think that's a general trend. That's why Twilight and all these vampires and werewolves are so popular. And I thought if you could harness that fascination and turn it into a power for the good, then you'd really have something going here. And they're so complex, these women. They lived in such challenging times, and they made such unexpected decisions. And all of them raise a very interesting question as to whether they would have been judged differently at a different time in history, if a couple of different factors had gone different ways, or if they had been men.
Hmm. There's been a lot of discussion about whether literature aimed at kids is too macabre, too involved with kind of difficult themes. And I think, you make the point that they're there anyway, number one. And number two, a lot of it, this is history. Now, this is not history, but we'll start with Cleopatra, just because that's where your series starts. And just to get a sense of how she is remembered, I want to play a clip. No, okay, I know this is not history. This is the movies, but this is what we have. The 1963 film with, of course, Elizabeth Taylor, the legend, and Rex Harrison playing Julius Caesar. And here it is.
Why have you now, Caesar? Besides, am I armies? And the simple fact that no mortal hand can destroy me.
Ah, yes. I seem to recall some mention of an obsession you have about your divinity. Isis, is it not?
I shall have to insist that you mind what you say. I am Isis. I am worshipped by millions who believe it.
First of all, one of the points that you make in the book is that the real Cleopatra did not look like Elizabeth Taylor. And the book kind of gives the historical narrative what is. No, but you also raise questions of, did she really do this? What's the evidence? And why did she think she had to do this? How did you settle on that approach?
We wanted to present these women as complex, three-dimensional characters, to give some balance to the stereotypes that are often out there, but also not to shy away or be afraid of the fact that they did make some very unpopular or immoral decisions. That was a general editorial approach that we took.
But are you trying to excuse them in a way from some of their nastier, truly dastardly deeds? Because some of them really are dastardly deeds.
No, I don't think that it's an apology either. You know, I don't think we're trying to excuse them, and we certainly don't condone a lot of things that they did. In fact, we get asked often why Cleopatra and Marie Antoinette are included in our series, because they've been so rehabilitated lately that there are people out there who say, why is Cleopatra a dastardly dame? She was a great queen. And our answer is that she was a great queen. She was a powerful queen, very intelligent woman, obviously so intellectually stimulating that she had two of the most powerful men of the time kind of fall at her feet without being a great beauty, as you noted. But at the same time, she condoned at the very least, if not encouraged or facilitated or even maybe connived, to have two of her brothers and one of her sisters murdered, which in our day and age we would say is a very dastardly thing. Although it was noted by Plutarch, the historian at the time, that all the best families did it, which I think is a wonderful quote. But my basic stance on this also is that when we started talking about doing the Dastardly Dames, we had a lot of people say, well, are you sure you want to do that? These aren't good role models. Why would you do that? And it kind of got all my feathers all roughed up, because I thought, we never ask this question about men. We never debate whether it's important to teach our children about powerful men, even if those powerful men were not saintly. You know, if a man is powerful and if he has affected history, we believe that our children should learn about him. But women who are powerful and have affected history, their stories don't get told because they weren't good enough. And I think that that's, first of all, unfair. And second of all, it gives children who are growing up nowadays a very biased view of what has been happening in history.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having the latest in our series of conversations acknowledging Women's History Month. This month, we decided to dig into biographies of notable women, and we decided to look at a series of books for tweens that profile some of history's most notorious and powerful women. We're speaking with Sharin Yim Bridges, the editor and publisher of the collection. In this collection, one of the things that tickled me a little bit is that you wrote one of the books yourself. It was Agrippina, the mm-hmm. Roman Empress who was the mother of one of the empire's most notorious rulers, Nero. And I have it that Agrippina was so unloved that nobody else wanted to write the biography, so it fell to you. Her nickname was Atrocious and Ferocious. So tell us a little bit about her. She's one of the people, I think, whose name is probably less well-known unless you've studied the classics.
Yes, and once again, you know, sometimes you wonder why, because here's this woman, she was the sister of Caligula, very, very well-known name, the wife of Claudius, again, very well-known, the mother of Nero, again, really well-known, and then greatly hated in her time because she was so powerful and had so much influence over these men and had so much to do with the running of the state. And we're talking about the early Roman Empire, which is a period of history that is on every curriculum and very well studied, and yet we do not know her name. I think that that's such a travesty. So she did actually fall to me because when the authors were picking which topics they would most prefer to write, nobody picked poor Agrippina. But in a way, I'm really glad that she did it. First of all, I love Roman history. And the other thing is that she was a challenge because finding her humanity was difficult. There's not that much that extant that has actually survived about her. And what was written by very hostile witnesses. But there are small details that I find in this woman who is formidable, very admirable. Towards the end of the story, you'll find that Nero, her son, tries to kill her, and he has her capsized at sea in a boat. And so you have to imagine that, you know, in the first century AD, this woman in multiple layers, if you read the book, you'll find out exactly how she was dressed. She actually managed somehow to swim all the way to shore. And then having gotten to shore, she goes home, and she has a few choices now. She can have her servants and her slaves. You know, she's a very wealthy woman living in a villa with lots of staff. She can have them protect her. She can call out the Praetorian guards who are loyal to her because she is the daughter of their great hero, Germanicus. She didn't do that either. You know, she sent them away from the villa because she knew that the second attack was coming. And rather than put her people in harm's way, she chose to face her murderers alone. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is an immense human moment. So anything else that you want to say about this woman, you cannot say that she did not have courage.
One of the points that the authors make in a number of these books is how these women, even if they had terrible reputations in the spotlight of history, tried to open up trade routes, tried to wield their power in different ways, or wielded their power in the same way that men did, in which eliminating one's enemies was a very common and understood political tactic. So as we said, we don't have time to talk about all of them, but is there one, aside from Agrippina, who is your favorite or who particularly intrigued you that you want to be sure you tell us about?
Well, I am a huge fan of Tudor history, and so I would have to say Mary Tudor, who's called Bloody Mary. And the reason why she, I think, is also kind of iconic for this series is that, you know, the title of every single book includes a nickname that that woman was given by her contemporaries. And I think each book tries to raise the question, was that nickname fair? And in Mary Tudor's case, I think it's especially enlightening that she was called Bloody Mary. And she was called Bloody Mary because in a time of religious strife, she sent about 300 Protestants to the stake. She burnt them. And that is a bloody and a dastardly thing. So you think, okay, she deserves Bloody Mary. But then you look at it from a different perspective and you think that her sister killed nearly as many for the exact same reasons, and she was called Good Queen Bess. Then you have to take a step back and then you think, why is one sister Bloody Mary and the other one Good Queen Bess? Well, you know, Bess won. Bess was on the side of the Protestants. England to this day is a Protestant country. If it had reverted to Catholicism, I'm willing to lay down money that the nicknames might have swapped. And then you have to look at Dad, you know. Their father was Henry VIII, who by some counts killed as many as 70,000. And yet his nickname is Great Harry. And so then you have to ask, well, now, does the gender bias also play in there? It's really interesting. And I think that what I say to kids all the time when I visit them in schools is that as someone who writes history books, I want you to know that history books are written by one person, usually by the winner. So bring that knowledge with you when you read these books and start to question, is there more that we can discover here rather than just staying with the surface stereotype?
Sharin Yim Bridges is the editor and publisher most recently of The Thinking Girl's Treasury of Dastardly Dames, and she was kind enough to join us from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Happy Women's History Month to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Michelle, for having me.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. News Corp executive James Murdoch is defending himself again. He's trying to convince the British Parliament that he told them the truth when he testified last year about scandals in his newspaper empire. NPR's David Folkenflik reports Murdoch is making his latest defense, even as his company faces some serious new troubles.
James Murdoch's letter to a parliamentary inquiry, written earlier this week and released today, seeks to deflect attacks on his testimony in the phone mail hacking and police bribery scandal that has cost so many British News Corp executives their jobs. It also comes at a time when the company is under both criminal and regulatory scrutiny. The British media regulator Ofcom has signaled it's undertaking a new review of whether News Corp is a fit and proper controlling owner of BSky B, the British broadcasting giant. In addition, the former CEO of News Corp's British newspaper arm, Rebecca Brooks, was arrested yesterday for a second time, this time on suspicion of perversion of justice. So was her husband, Charlie Brooks, along with the British newspaper division's top security official and three others. Brooks has proved an embarrassment both to the Murdoch family and to her close friend, Prime Minister David Cameron. He had to acknowledge earlier this month riding a horse she and her husband, Charlie Brooks, had been given by police officials.
And he's a good friend, and he's a neighbour in the constituency. We live a few miles apart. I haven't been riding with him since the election, as I said yesterday. Before the election, yes, I did go riding with him. He has a number of different horses, and yes, one of them was this former police horse, Razor, which I did ride.
Murdoch and the company have been cooperating with the police and parliamentary inquiries. In July, he told MPs he was ill-served by his top executives who failed to bring the issue sufficiently to his attention.
I have to tell you, I know and I sympathize with the frustration of this committee, and it's a matter of real regret that the facts could not emerge and could not be gotten to my understanding, faster.
Though there had been arrests in 2006, a big settlement in 2008, and an expose by The Guardian in 2009, James Murdoch said he knew little of the extent of phone hacking until a lawsuit in 2010. But the final editor of the News of the World and the paper's former top lawyer testified they told Murdoch in 2008 that phone hacking was widespread at News of the World to convince him to make the huge payout to keep a hacking victim quiet. In September, Conservative MP Damian Collins questioned former News of the World editor Colin Myler over what Murdoch was told.
He is very clear on his recollection of that meeting. You are not. And that is my question.
I am clear. I'm sorry, but I am clear. There was no ambiguity about the significance of that document and what options were there for the company to take.
Murdoch subsequently handed over an email exchange that showed he was warned of a nightmare scenario. This week, Murdoch wrote to MPs that he simply hadn't read that full exchange, and that outside in 6, a big settlement in 2008, and an expose by The Guardian in 2009, James Murdoch said he knew little of the extent of phone hacking until a lawsuit in 2010. But the final editor of the News of the World and the paper's former top lawyer testified they told Murdoch in 2008 that phone hacking was widespread at News of the World to convince him to make the huge payout to keep a hacking victim quiet. In September, Conservative MP Damian Collins questioned former News of the World editor Colin Myler over what Murdoch was told.
He is very clear on his recollection of that meeting. You are not.